David is in the king's court, and we read about that in the first 9 verses of chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic, and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. And as they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. I'm going to pause reading there. David has killed the giant Goliath. One day, he's in obscurity, a shepherd boy looking after some sheep, had this slightly strange incident of Samuel coming to anoint him as king, but nothing happens straight away, so perhaps he's wondering, what did that all mean, really? So there he is in obscurity, comes to visit the battle, sees what's going on with Goliath, kills Goliath, as we looked at last week, and now, suddenly, from obscurity, he's brought into the king's court, and as this chapter proceeds and into the next one, becomes very, very famous and popular, from celebrity to from obscurity to celebrity. But at the same time, in proportion with that, he becomes a target for Saul's jealousy. And that's really the theme that's kicked off in those first 9 verses, which continues through these 2 chapters. Jonathan's seen all that's happened with Goliath. He's seen also how his father Saul's been reigning. And he's heard what David has said to his father Saul. If you look back in chapter 14, verse 29, Jonathan says this about Saul, his father. "My father has made trouble for this country. He knows that Saul is not the king that God wants him to be." And in contrast to that, he sees David as a man of faith and a man of commitment and a man of heroic faith, who's not afraid to put his faith to the test. A man who's really trusting God for victory. And immediately, Jonathan recognizes, compared with Saul, who's done nothing but trouble for this country, he sees David, someone who's a man of God, a man after God's own heart. And he sees that, and he is so humble that he recognizes that immediately. You see, men of faith are always ready to recognize when God is at work in other people and to give God the credit and to give them the credit. It's hard for proud men to recognize God equipping other people. But Jonathan is such a wonderful example of that here. He recognizes the true king, and in humility, he submits to him. We're going to discuss a little bit more the friendship between David and Jonathan in a couple of weeks' time. But just worth saying, just in case you're pondering as you're reading through this, that there's nothing gay about this relationship between David and Jonathan. There's no hint or suggestion about it in the Bible, and it's not as though the Bible shies away from talking about it. It's pretty clear when gay sex is what is spoken about, that's very clear in the places where it is spoken about. So it's not as though the Bible is kind of covering it up. So there's no hint or suggestion of it in the Bible. And really, to suggest that is grasping at straws if you want to kind of try and justify it biblically. And it really flies in the face and loses, actually, what's actually here in front of us in 1 Samuel 18 and later, which is what Jonathan is really doing is showing the best kind of manly love, which is allegiance and covenant loyalty and recognizing God at work in someone else. What Jonathan does is, here's the true king, David, And I'm going to give him all the marks of kingship that I've got as the son of the king. He gives him his royal robe and his sword and even his tunic and his bow and his belt. He's trying to say, all the stuff that kind of shows that I'm royal, I'm giving to you because I can see that you're the real royal person here. What he's really doing is what we all hope Prince Charles does, which is to abdicate. And do I get put in the Tower of London for saying that? I don't know. Perhaps some kind person would strike that from the recording, but I reckon some of you would rather that, whatever his name is, Prince William, isn't it? I can just show that I'm not a royalist. It's Prince William, the next one down, isn't it? The one who's got the baby and all, yeah. You're going to dislike me even more now because I don't even know what they're called. Most of you would like him to be king, wouldn't you? Well, what Jonathan is doing is saying, I'm happy not to be king. I'm happy that David's king instead of me. And from the court, the royal court, being in the presence of the king, David is sent out on missions. He leads the army. And he's promoted. And he's got this great reputation as a great leader. Verse 5, whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. Gets promoted through the army. Everybody loves him. And then verse 7, there's 6 and 7, there's probably a flashback to when the army was returning from the battle that involved Goliath and plundering the Philistines, to give, I suppose, a context to Saul's growing jealousy. And what it says is there's cheerleaders. We don't really have them much in this country, but you imagine kind of American baseball games and basketball games and cheerleaders and stuff. And well, there's some cheerleaders with tambourines and lutes, and they're singing this song, which has this rather catchy chorus. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. It's actually not quite as bad as it sounds, because in kind of Hebrew poetry, what the poem is doing is kind of making Saul and Jonathan equivalent. But that's how it kind of would sound in Hebrew poetry, because it's just sort of building from one to the other. The trouble is, Saul hears it a bit like we'd hear it. It's as though he's forgotten all his Hebrew poetry lessons, and he hears it as, they're saying that David kills more than I can kill. They're saying that David's better than me. And he becomes jealous of David. You see, Saul knows in his heart that the Lord is no longer with him. We've thought about that the last few weeks in 1 Samuel, haven't we? The Lord is no longer with Saul, but he's now with David, and Saul can see that, and it's like water in Saul's hands. The kingdom, he can feel it. It's just flowing away from him. It's just ebbing away. He's losing it. He can feel that, but he tries as hard as he can to sort of keep hold of this water that's just dripping and just running through his hands. And then verse 10, there's an evil spirit, a troubling spirit that comes from God. Maybe an overwhelming sense that he is not with him anymore, that God is not with him anymore. And it says he was prophesying in his house. That sounds a very positive word, but it's the same word that you could use for raving, which is used a little bit later in chapter 19. So he's kind of in some kind of an ecstatic state, some kind of fitting state. That's going on, and he throws his spear, as it says, at David, tries to pin him to the wall, but David eluded him twice, it says. And then we have verses 12 through to 16, where David is sent away, motivated by fear. See that at the beginning of verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns. And again, he's very successful. In everything he did, he gained great success. He had great success because the Lord was with him, not with Saul, with David, and so he is successful. Maybe Saul thought, if I send David away on these campaigns far away, at the power base where I'm at, where I am, everyone will forget about him and he won't be a threat to me anymore. But that's not what happens. The people love him. All Israel, verse 16, all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. Not a weak leader like Saul, not an indecisive leader like Saul, not an unfaithful to God leader like Saul. They loved David because he was a great leader under God. Then verses 17 through to 30, David marries. Saul probably wanted David either dead or at least out of his hair, but none of those things are working. So you know that saying about keeping your friends close but keeping your enemies even closer? Saul then tries that tactic. Let's try and marry him into my family, and then somehow I can either, by sort of a sense of allegiance, control him, or maybe through one of my daughters, control him. So he tries to marry off his eldest daughter with David. But that doesn't work. David humbly declines. He's innocent of all the intrigue involved in all that. And then he tries to marry off his second daughter. See that in verse 20. Now, Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David, and when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. Then Saul ordered his attendants, speak to David privately and say, look, the king is pleased with you and his attendants all like you. Now become his son-in-law. But David declines again with a humble answer. And then Saul has this answer, which some of us might find a little bit uncomfortable. When Saul's servants told him what David had said, Saul replied, say to David, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies. Saul's plan was for David's fall by the hand of the Philistines. So again, David at first declines to marry Michal, the second daughter of Saul. But then he's persuaded with this statement from Saul through his attendants to say, well, the bride price is 100 foreskins. David does better on that. He doubles that and comes back with 200. I guess Saul thought that in kind of a fit of romantic passion and enthusiasm, that Saul would go kind of plunging into the Philistines to battle, trying to get these trophies, and that he would just lose terribly because he wasn't thinking straight, like people in love don't always think straight. But it doesn't work, and he comes back with 200. Just don't think about it, guys, as to quite how those were extracted, alive or dead, and this image of them being counted in front of... it's a sense of the complete humiliation of the enemy, and in a sense bringing them under the rule and the covenant sign, ironically, of the Israelites. And the consequence, verses 28 and 29, is Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David. Saul became still more afraid of him and he remained his enemy for the rest of his days. Saul's ploys to get rid of David have all completely failed. In fact, it's worse than that. Pretty much everyone can see that the Lord is with David. His son Jonathan loves David. His daughter Michal loves David and is married to David. Everything is unraveling for Saul. And the reason is given really clearly in this chapter. It's because the Lord has departed from Saul and the Lord is with David. And this is not arbitrary. This is because Saul has consistently pushed the Lord's word and the Lord's will away. And David, up to this point, has consistently trusted in the Lord and accepted his word and aligned himself with God's people and God's purposes. Then we're into chapter 19, where in those first 17 verses, David escapes assassination. There's a dramatic upping of the stakes. Chapter 19, verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, my father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and tell you what I find out." Saul spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you. And what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason?" So rather than obeying his father and killing David, Jonathan speaks up for David, speaks up for David's innocence, speaks up for David's exploits, and says, "This is so stupid, Saul. David has been brilliant for you. He's been faithful. What he has done has benefited you and your kingdom. What are you doing?" And he extracts this promise from Saul that he's not going to put him to death. See that in verse 6. So David returns to the royal court and wins another set of battle with the Philistines. See that in verse 8. "And they fled before him." But again, verse 9, another day, another troubled spirit for Saul. He's sitting in his house with his spear in his hand while David was playing the harp. And then verse 10, "Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. And that night, David made good his escape." That seems to be the last straw, or the last spear, that is going to be thrown in this way by Saul. And he realizes he really does need to get out of town. But Saul sends assassins after him. See that verse 11. "Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, 'If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed.' So Michal let David down through a window and he fled and escaped. Then Michal took an idol and laid it in the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at the head." Dramatic upping of the stakes then. Saul has asked Jonathan to kill David. He's extracted a promise and David is back, but Saul still in a moment is ready to kill David again, and David has left, gone back to his house. Saul sends assassins to his house, and then there's this dramatic escape. Michal realizes you can't hang around, the men are waiting, they're waiting to kill you. You really do absolutely need to get out of this place. So Michal helps, pretends that David's ill. So the people come in and maybe see a kind of a shape in the bed and some goat's hair or something. Remember, it's dark. They're not going to be shining torches and stuff. So it's probably quite easy to have that kind of ruse. And they're going to believe the king's daughter anyway. So she does that. That gives David enough time to get away. He's long gone by the morning. Just as an aside, really, there is, it would seem, a Bible principle. Particularly see it a few times in the Old Testament, where there comes times, they're not very frequent, but there does sometimes come a moment where you have to choose between different laws that God has put in place. And there are moments where, if it's to do with the preserving of life that would be unjustly and wrongly taken, sometimes people in the Old Testament do cover over the truth, or they say things to deflect those who are intent on murder. You'll see that a few times in the Old Testament. I think it's a fair principle to say you have to make a judgment that life is so sacred and so important, sometimes it has to be preserved in that way. But it's a hard judgment. Some of you who are a bit older would remember the story of Corrie ten Boom in the Netherlands during Nazi occupation. She sheltered a lot of Jewish refugees. And I think there was a difference between her and her sister. She had resolved in her heart that if the Germans came for the people who were housed with her, that she would lie and say they're not here, or deflect them in some other way. I think her sister took a different view, that she would tell the truth and God would protect them. So it's a matter of some discussion, but it seems to me quite clear through the Old Testament that there are moments when the preserving of life really is a supreme thing, and sometimes we have to take steps to do that. That's mostly not going to be your experience, but it's just something just to notice. It's perhaps a question that went through your mind as we were looking at that. Having said that, I'm not so sure about Michael's second lie at the end of verse 17, when Saul says, "Why did you do this? Why did you deceive me?" And Michael says, "He said to me, 'Let me get away. Why should I kill you? He threatened to kill me, Dad.'" Not sure that lie was entirely necessary, but I think the first one probably was. So David, verse 18, he flees to Samuel. Where else would you go but to hear from the man of God, the man who brings God's word? So that's where David goes to Ramah, where Samuel is, and Saul hears about it. So verse 20, he sent men to capture him. But when they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied or raved. It's not quite clear what the meaning is. Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. Saul sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. Finally, he himself, Saul, left for Ramah and went to the great cistern at Seku, and he asked, "Where are Samuel and David?" "Over in Naoth at Ramah," they said. So Saul went to Naoth at Ramah. But the Spirit of God came even upon him, and he walked along prophesying, and he came to Naoth. He stripped off his robes and also prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay that way all day and night. That is why people say, ironically, is Saul also among the prophets? David is so confused, he goes to see the man of God. Saul sends his assassins there to capture him. They are overtaken by the power of God's Spirit, so Saul himself goes. And there's this bizarre scene as Saul himself gets there, starts prophesying, strips off his royal robes, is utterly humiliated. It's just a figure of ridicule there as God overcomes him. It's kind of a symbol of his rule, really, and the humiliation of Saul is complete. It's the power of God. Makes us all look fools, really, just like Saul. Let's spend a few minutes thinking about what we can learn from these couple of chapters. David hardly speaks at all in these two chapters. Virtually nothing is said by him. Just a few words expressing humble surprise that he's even there at all in the royal court and that he should even be chosen to be the king's son-in-law. Cheerfully, quietly, he's getting on with being the best servant, the best soldier. But it does get hard for David. What does he think about it? Well, Psalm 59 helps us. Psalm 59 was written around about this time. And these are some words, some thoughts of David. Look at verses 9, 10, and 17, where David says, "You are my strength. I watch for you. You, God, are my fortress, my God on whom I rely. God will go before me. You are my strength. I sing praise to you. You, God, are my fortress, my God on whom I can rely." That's the chorus, the refrain. You're my fortress, my God on whom I can rely. Saul is completely unraveling before me. He's chucking spears at me. He wants to kill me. He's sending men to kill me. They're hiding outside my house. Where are you, God? You are my fortress, my God on whom I can rely. I've been anointed as king, and I don't really know what that means, but it doesn't seem to be working out very well because Saul hates me. Where are you, God? You are my God on whom I rely. David is such a great example of faithful trust in God, despite this awful persecution that he's going through. We're going to see that a few times through the rest of David's life. You can imagine him going to Samuel and saying, "I'm just bewildered. I don't know what's going on. You came and you anointed me. And before that, my life was pretty straightforward. I looked after sheep and I killed animals and I trusted in God and I composed a few songs and life was fine. Now look what a mess it is. The people love me, but the king hates me and he's got the power. I almost died loads of times. What's going on, Samuel?" But ultimately, although I'm sure he expresses his frustration and bewilderment and confusion, ultimately he knows, just like he knew when he faced Goliath, he knows that God is in control and that God is with him and that God is a mighty fortress and that God is not confused or bewildered or put off track by these events. That's his trust. I wonder if it's your trust this morning. He's a great man of faith. He's a great example to us. There's all kinds of bewildering and confusing things that happen to you. I wonder if you're able to say, the Lord, my God, is my fortress. He's the one on whom I rely. Things are going wrong. Things are unraveling. Things are spiraling out of control. There's my own sin and there's my enemies and there's all that's going wrong in my life. It's all going wrong, but God is still on the throne. And I believe that. Do you believe that this morning? David's a great example of faith. But the way these two chapters are constructed, that is absolutely there. But really the focus is on people's response to David. Really everyone here, Jonathan, the singers, the general population, the soldiers, Saul's daughter, Michael, and Saul himself, they're all really defined by this. What do they say about David? What do they do about David? And it raises a question for you. Are you rejecting the Lord's anointed? Saul, pretty much exclusively, if you sort of discount his soldiers who are just obeying orders, Saul is the one who stands out in this chapter because he doesn't recognize the man anointed to be king. He knows the kingdom's no longer his. He knows God has chosen someone else. He's been told that. He clearly sees that David is the heir apparent. That's obvious from what he says. He clearly sees all that, but he refuses to really acknowledge it, to really recognize it. Worse than that, he tries to prevent it. Of course, every plan to oppose God is thwarted, because God is with David and he's not with Saul, so David escapes in chapter 19. But Saul's intent is to oppose God's plan. And it's motivated by his envy. It's what happens 1,000 years later. The true king comes, the greater king than David comes, Jesus Christ comes, and he is the Lord's anointed. He is the one that God has given all power and authority to be king over all men. That's Jesus. He's the Christ. It means the anointed one. And Jesus comes to his people, to Israel, and he's rejected. The Jewish leaders are jealous. They feel threatened. It culminates in the crucifixion. See that in Matthew 27, verse 18. It's in Mark's gospel as well. And there's a call for Jesus to be crucified. And Pilate sees, as he offers them Barabbas instead, he sees that it's out of envy. It's out of envy that they handed Jesus over. They're rejecting the Lord's anointed because they envy him, because they're threatened by him, because he opposes their power base, because he opposes the hold they have over people, because he questions their real heart righteousness, because he says you're not right with God, because your hearts are all wrong. You're like whitewashed tombs, clean on the outside, but inside full of filth and dead men's bones. That's what you're like. He threatens them. And they're not humble enough. They're not wise enough. See that here is the true king. I need to admit that. I need to acknowledge that. I need to own up to that. Rather, they go out of their way to reject the true king. So much for the Pharisees. What about you this morning? It's very easy to respectfully reject Jesus. You're not calling on him to be crucified. You're not standing up being rude in the meeting, but you're welcome to have a go. Wouldn't be the worst thing that's ever happened here. But you'll be polite, and maybe you won't actively call for Jesus to be rejected, but in your heart, you are rejecting Jesus. You see, the thing is, when Jesus comes to us, he always comes as a threat. He's a wonderful Savior. He's a loving Lord. But he always comes as a threat. What does he threaten? He threatens our lordship of ourselves. He threatens our rule of ourselves. He threatens our little kingdom of ourselves. Jesus always comes to you as a threat. If Jesus hasn't come to you as a threat, you haven't really met the true Jesus. You've met some kind of soft soap version of Jesus, some kind of take it or leave it consumer Jesus, some Jesus who meets your need only but isn't your master. But if the true Jesus comes to you, he always comes as a threat. And I ask you this morning, are you rejecting the Lord's anointed? He threatens your pride. He threatens you keeping religion kind of controlled inside a box. He threatens your Sunday lying. He threatens your dabbling with pornography. He threatens your gossiping. He threatens your quest for power. He threatens your sin. He threatens your view of yourself as a pretty good person. He threatens your system of feeling good about yourself. He threatens your framework by which you think you're going to get saved and get happy and get all right. He threatens all those things. He stands towering above us much more than David in this story here. And ultimately he wins. He always wins because God is with him. He's the Lord's anointed. Jesus always wins. It won't make any difference if you reject him to him. It won't make any difference to his rule. But it'll make an eternity of difference to your future. Are you rejecting the Lord's anointed? Or will you, like many people in this story, accept Jesus as the rightful king in your place? And will you give him your allegiance? Jonathan accepts the coming king. He's the big example of that here in these couple of chapters. He's giving his armor as a sign that the promised king is going to be David, not Jonathan. And part of becoming a Christian, part of putting your faith in Jesus, is to say, you're the king, not me. I pledge myself to you. Whatever I have, whatever I am, whatever trappings of being royal and ruling myself, whatever I've got, I'm just going to take it off and give it to you because you're the true king. Faith in Jesus gives up the rights we have to honor. And it says, I want to love Jesus. I want to honor Jesus. I want to pledge myself to Jesus. I want to stand up for Jesus. See how Jonathan does that? Because he's pledged himself to David. What does he do when Saul wants to kill David? He stands up for David. He's not afraid to take his own life in his hands and oppose his father, the king. He stands up for Jesus because he's pledged to Jesus. He obeys the law of the land. He's not going to start a rebellion. He's not going to try and overthrow Saul. He ends up later in the story fighting with Saul. Fighting alongside Saul, that is, against the Philistines. So he doesn't rebel, but he has shifted his allegiance from Saul to David as the ultimate king. And you need to do that this morning to be free, to be happy, to be forgiven, to be secure, to be on the right side. To be who you are meant to be, you need to give up allegiance to whoever and whatever and give it over to Jesus and say, I want Jesus, I want you to be my king and I want to stand up for you, I want to live for you, I want to follow you, I want you to be the ruler. Could you say that this morning? I pledge my allegiance to King Jesus, whatever it means for my own status. These Old Testament chapters are great for kind of just presenting the choice before us. You're going to be like Saul this morning, or you're going to be like Jonathan? Whoever you are this morning, you've got a kind of answer. Are you going to be like Saul, rejecting the Lord's anointed, who is Jesus? Or are you going to be like Jonathan, who accepts the Lord's anointed, who for us is Jesus? Who are you going to be this morning? Are you going to be Saul? Are you going to be Jonathan? I urge you, I encourage you, I warmly invite you to be like Jonathan. And so I pledge myself to you, Jesus, the true King. I want to follow you. I want to stand up for you because I know you're the true King. You're my leader. And in you, I find ultimate happiness and joy. You can't be neutral in these things. You can't just observe them. So that's interesting, Saul, Jonathan. You're one or the other. The question for us this morning is, what will you do with the Lord's anointed?